2012, January 17th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 10, The Air We Breathe, the Earth's Atmosphere. We're continuing our exploration of life in the universe by looking at our home planet. Last time we talked about the Earth as a planet and looked at the interior of the Earth and saw that it was a geologically active place. The crust is broken up into 16 tectonic plates. There's volcanic activity, there's continual recycling of the crust, and we have a very dynamic planet, mostly covered with water. Today I want to turn to the other attribute of the planet that's important for life, namely the Earth's atmosphere, the air that we breathe. Today I want to look at the properties of the Earth's atmosphere that are germane to this question of life on Earth. We're going to use the atmosphere of the Earth as one of our standards for comparison when we go out to talk about other planets. So we have to establish what a terrestrial atmosphere should look like. If we look at the present, the basic facts to get across today are that the present day atmosphere is mostly nitrogen and oxygen. But a lesson we're going to see today and in a lecture on Thursday is this was not always the case. The Earth's atmosphere composition has changed over its history. How and why is very important for understanding and is inextricably tied up with both the geologic history of the Earth and life on Earth. The atmosphere we're going to see has a vertical structure. It's divided into roughly 5 thermal layers. Those are also going to be somewhat important for setting the properties of the atmosphere. When we go to places like Mars or Venus and ask what the properties of the atmosphere are, differences of its vertical structure from what we find on the Earth are going to be important to understanding, perhaps, why the Earth is habitable but Mars and Venus are not. Another very important fact, which is going to determine the type of atmosphere a planet has, is going to be the planet's gravity. It turns out that one fact we're going to see today, and we're going to set the stage for something we're going to repeat over and over again, is that the Earth has an atmosphere of mostly nitrogen and oxygen, but hydrogen and helium are the most abundant elements in the universe, and they're virtually absent from the Earth's atmosphere. And the reason for that, it will turn out that the Earth is too small, its gravity is too weak to hold on to these gases. This is something we're going to be introduced today, but we're going to see over and over again as we talk about what are one of the factors that makes a planet habitable. We're also going to see the greenhouse effect. Greenhouse effect gets a lot of press, but in fact, the greenhouse effect is a normal property of all atmospheres. On the Earth, it has one particular property that's important to us. It actually makes the Earth 35 degrees Celsius warmer than it would be if it had no atmosphere. That makes the difference between water being ice and liquid. So the greenhouse effect is absolutely essential, and the magnitude of that effect is absolutely essential to the Earth's habitability. So it's another factor of where the atmosphere plays into the question of life. And finally, a fact we're going to pick up today, but we're going to talk in more detail on Thursday about, is that the primordial, the original or early atmosphere of the Earth, was very, very different than it is today. Atmospheres are not static. They are very dynamic, and they evolve over the history of a planet. So they affect everything about the habitability of that world. And we're going to set the stage for understanding that the Earth has not just a geological history, but has a detailed climate history that we can read off from a combination of the geological record and some understanding about the dynamics of atmospheres. So today we're going to introduce the Earth's atmosphere, the air that we breathe, its basic properties today, and set the stage for the discussion of climate history, which is important for understanding the history of life on Earth, and then beginning to understand what are the conditions that a planet like the Earth must have in order to be habitable. So let's look in detail. If we took the Earth and we sort of imagine like it's the side of a cereal box, what are the contents and how much of what is in there? If we look at the Earth's contents of the Earth's atmosphere, this very thin skin of gases that sits on top of the oceans and the land of the Earth, what we find going from most abundant to least abundant, again, you don't need to memorize the exact proportions, but you should understand what they are, is the two most abundant elements, the two most abundant compounds in the Earth's atmosphere is molecular nitrogen, N2, a molecule consisting of two nitrogen atoms, makes up 78% of the composition of the Earth's atmosphere, followed by 21% of molecular oxygen. Do the math here. 78 plus 21 is 99%. So these are the dominant constituents. That's why I've highlighted them in yellow. The remaining 1% is water vapor. Now, if you've done the math, you say, well, that's 100%. I guess we can stop now. Obviously, I've rounded off a bit. So we've got a little bit extra going on. There's about 0.93% argon, and then a tiny amount. Notice we suddenly jump from a whole percent to a fraction of a thousandest, 38,000th of a percent, carbon dioxide. We hear an awful lot about carbon dioxide these days, the subject of global warming and human impacts on the atmosphere. This is one of the reasons why that's such an issue. There's a very tiny amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, but it has a huge effect, as we're going to see. Once we get past these top five constituents, nitrogen, oxygen, water vapor, argon, which turns out to be a byproduct of radioactive potassium decay, that's why it's so abundant, and carbon dioxide, we get into traces of other stuff. Methane, for example, a compound, carbon plus four hydrogens, makes up a tiny trace of the Earth's atmosphere, but it turns out to be, as we're going to see, one of the important greenhouse trapping gases in the Earth's atmosphere. It's a byproduct, in this case, in the Earth's atmosphere, of biological activity. It's mostly from decay of biomass. Cows and sheep, football teams, things like that. Inert gases. We actually have a number of the noble gases start to combine in the atmosphere. Neon, tiny traces of helium. This is not helium from space. This is helium coming up from deep wells in the Earth and cracks in the Earth's surface. This is actually helium as a byproduct of radioactive decay in the Earth's deep interior. Remember, helium was first discovered in the sun, but was discovered on the Earth as well gas, because it would bubble up from deep oil wells and water wells. Krypton and xenon, these are all noble gases, which combined with argon are chemically inert. They're there, but they don't do much for us. And finally, another feature of our atmosphere is that there are a lot of particulate materials, not molecules now, but actually solid little tiny dusty bits of stuff, primarily composed of silicates, that's basically ground up rock dust. Sand, for example, huge sandstorms kick silicates up into the upper atmosphere. That forms a constituent of the solid particles in the atmosphere, become sites, for example, that water can nucleate around to form clouds. Sea salt is actually a fairly strong particulate consistent constituent of our atmosphere. Again, tiny bits of dried out salt grains float through the atmosphere and actually form nucleation sites for cloud formation. And sulfates. These are particulate sulfur-bearing particles, primarily belched out by volcanoes, but also can be belched out by, you know, large factories burning rich sulfur coal that get up into the Earth's atmosphere. These particulates play a number of roles. They can absorb sunlight, they can reflect sunlight, and they form the nucleation sites for water droplets that lead to the formation of clouds, snowflakes, things like that. So these are the basic constituents of our atmosphere. But the real bottom line here is that if you sample the air anywhere on the surface, it's mostly nitrogen and a bit of oxygen. Carbon dioxide is just a tiny trace. Keep that one in the back of your mind. And hydrogen and helium, except for, again, tiny traces from radioactive decay, are absent. These are important clues because we're going to see differences when we go to other planetary atmospheres. And the primary differences are going to be the amounts of carbon dioxide compared to everything else. Now, the atmosphere itself is not just simply one big layer. It's actually kind of a five-layer cake on top of the Earth here that ranges in altitude from the ground level all the way up to about 690 kilometers. 690 kilometers up, actually somewhere around 100 kilometers, is usually the transition between space and the atmosphere. But really, even satellites are up in the upper atmosphere, like the space station and the shuttle, fly up at these layers here, which are the so-called thermosphere. It's really only when you get to the exosphere, when the atmosphere of the Earth begins to merge into interplanetary space, that you really leave the atmosphere. The atmosphere part that we care about is called the troposphere. It's the zone of weather. It goes from the ground up to about 10 kilometers. That 10 kilometers is higher than the highest mountain peaks, which are about 8 kilometers up, Mount Everest and the 8,000-meter peaks in the world. High cirrus clouds, low puffy clouds like the ones dumping water on us, and which I think they're threatening to dump snow on us later, live down in this lower area. This is the area of weather. All the weather that we experience comes from this lower 10-kilometer level. This red line that I've drawn here on scale shows the change in temperature as we go through these layers. As I go to the left of the diagram here, I get cooler temperatures. I go to the right, I get hotter temperatures. For anyone who's lived near mountains, you know that as I go from the ground and climb up in altitude, I drop in temperature pretty rapidly. I work, for example, a lot at Mount Graham in Arizona. It's 10,500 feet elevation, 3,300 meters, since we've got to do metric. I go from the valley floor, where it can be 106 degrees in the summertime. It's a cool 50 degrees Fahrenheit by the time I get up to the summit. And yet, I'm under the same sun and basically the same atmosphere. All I've done is climb vertically. But as I get higher in the atmosphere gets thinner. It actually gets warmer. As I go into the next layer, between 10 and 20, 50 kilometers, called the stratosphere. It's in the stratosphere at a height around 30 kilometers that I find the so-called ozone layer. Ozone is O3, three oxygen atoms combined into a molecule. It gets its formation from ultraviolet light striking oxygen and water as you go up higher in the atmosphere. It's formed from those from these UV photoradiation. This forms a layer that absorbs ultraviolet radiation that would normally reach the ground. The ozone layer is extremely important to us. It shields the ground from harmful UV radiation from the sun. But that UV radiation has got to go somewhere, and where it goes into is heating the air. So that's why the temperature rises through the stratosphere. When you get above the stratosphere, above 50 kilometers, you get into sort of this middle zone called the mesosphere, from the Greek word meso, meaning in the middle, which runs from about 50 to 85 kilometers, and now it behaves like you'd expect. As you go higher and the air gets thinner, it gets cooler again. It thins out a great deal. We finally get then up into a place called the thermosphere, where the temperature starts to rise again. You can see how each of these layers is defined by the behavior of temperature changes with height. That's why they're called thermal layers. The thermosphere is heated by sunlight striking atoms in the high atmosphere and molecules and ionizing them, actually kicking electrons off of those atoms. Those electrons go into heating the air. Now, the air is extremely thin up here, as we'll see in a moment. But you have a source of heating, trapping of sunlight a little bit. But there's only a little bit of atmosphere, so it's easy to heat. It gets hotter again. And then finally, in the exosphere, the temperature begins to rise again until it starts to merge into the high-temperature interplanetary gas, the general run of gas that lives in the space between the planets, that's mostly the solar wind bubbling off the sun, with temperatures of many hundreds of thousands of degrees. So each of these five layers represent changes in the temperature profile, the temperature behavior, due to a combination of cooling. You simply are going up in altitude, the pressure's letting off, and when you let the pressure off a normal gas, it cools off. But then an additional source of heating comes into play. UV absorption of sunlight in the ozone layer, UV ionization of atoms in the upper atmosphere can lead to heating. Each of these different changes gives us this layering effect. On other planets, we can look for this layering effect because it gives some clues as to the nature of the atmosphere. Now, the main other fact of this is as we go higher in altitude, the pressure drops very, very rapidly. At sea level, forgive my use of non-metric units here as a conversion, the typical pressure of air is the equivalent of 1 kilogram for every square centimeter, or the traditional 14 pounds per square inch. So what that is the weight of all the air from my hand all the way to the top of the atmosphere is 1 kilogram equivalent weight for every square centimeter of area on my hand. Because we're always immersed in it, we don't experience it in the same way that if I put a kilo in your hand, you'd suddenly feel the weight change. The weight's always there. We can feel it because we actually swim through the atmosphere of the Earth. A good way of analogizing this is you've all probably gone into a swimming pool and you've dived down to deeper and deeper levels. As you go deeper underwater, the weight of the water, you can feel the increased pressure on your ears. You've also experienced the change in pressure with height if you've gone up in an airplane or you've climbed to high altitude. As the pressure gets lower, you can feel it in your inner eardrums. Your ears are pressure-sensitive organs. And so the first thing that happens is when I go to high altitude, I suddenly feel my ears begin to pop around 7,000 feet. If I've got a cold like I do today, I am miserable for a week up there. Okay, because the change in pressure differential from inside to outside. How much does the pressure drop? Turns out it drops exponentially, very, very fast, such that it drops by 50% for every 5.6 kilometers of altitude gain. So what that means is if I go up 5,600 meters, which is kind of, 6,000 meters, it's pushing up around 20,000 feet altitude. The air pressure at 20,000 feet is half what it is at sea level. This is why high alpine climbers and Everest climbers have to carry oxygen with them. By the time you get to 11 kilometers, which is a typical altitude for a commercial jetliner, either in a transcontinental or intercontinental flight, you've got 25% of the air pressure at sea level. That's why airliners are pressurized. They're actually pressurized to an equivalent of about, was it 5,000 or 6,000 degrees altitude? Sorry?
I think it's 10,000.
No, it's not 10,000. I've been to 10,000 at Mount Graham, and I definitely don't feel the altitude the same as I do in an airliner. I think it's closer to 7,000. But we'll disagree. We'll look that one up in Google. We'll look it up in Google when we get back. When I get up to 56 kilometers, well up into the stratosphere, and the transition between the stratosphere and the mesosphere, 1/1,000th, 0.1% of the air pressure at that point. So even though the temperature is rising, it's getting very, very thin. A good example of this is Mount Everest. When you get to the summit of Mount Everest, is the highest mountain on the Earth. It's at 8,850 meters. Climbers up at the top of Mount Everest are experiencing 1/3 the air pressure at sea level. That means 1/3 the oxygen with every breath. Well, I work a lot at 10,500 feet. I feel the lack of oxygen up there. One of the observatories I've worked at is at 4,000 meters, 14,000 feet on Mauna Kea. You feel stupid on top of Mauna Kea. We write stuff out at sea level and we bring it up to the mountain with us because you're a drooler by the middle of the night after a few hours in that. The highest observatories in the world right now are in the high Atacama Desert of Chile at 16,000 feet. There, we actually oxygenate the control rooms because you'd just be a babbling fool after about an hour in that if you don't actually get sick from altitude. So this change in altitude is very important. It basically sets a zone of habitability at the bottom of the atmosphere. There really is, somewhere around the high cols and valley and plateaus on Everest, a place that alpine climbers call the death zone. Because there's so little oxygen, without oxygen assistance, you are slowly dying. You're not getting enough oxygen to sustain your body. And virtually nothing lives up here except for a few very highly adapted forms of life. So all of life, all the weather, everything occurs in the lowest levels. So a good way to think about this is half of the Earth's atmosphere, half of the mass of the Earth's atmosphere is below 18,000 feet. That's where we live. About 90% is below about 16 kilometers, about 52,000 feet. So most of the atmosphere lives in the troposphere and below. A little bit into the stratosphere if you want to push it to 90%, but not a lot. At 16 kilometers, you're only barely into the stratosphere. And that's about as high as the highest aircraft fly under normal circumstances. You can go higher than that, but a routine flight at 16 kilometers, 50,000 feet is pretty common for, say, intercontinental flights, a high like a 747 crossing the Pacific. You're flying above 90% of the air on the Earth when you're doing that. That's an idea of how very quickly the pressure drops off inside of the Earth's atmosphere. And all of this really has to do with the fact that as you go higher, there's less air above you. There's less weight of it being pulled down by the Earth's gravity on top of you. And that's entirely what it's caused by. We refer to this sometimes as pressure scale height or pressure height. It's a very common feature of atmospheres, so it's one we're going to be paying attention to a lot. In fact, it gives us a way of comparing the atmosphere of one planet to the Earth. We can talk about what the pressure is at the surface, say, of Mars or Venus, or I can express that as, for example, standing on the surface of Mars is equivalent to being at the altitude of, I'll make up a number, some number of kilometers high in the Earth's atmosphere, and that's a way of setting the scale of comparison that's, to my mind, a little bit easier to get my head around than so many kilograms per square centimeter of pressure. So that's the vertical structure of our atmosphere. Now, what's interesting about our atmosphere is we looked at the composition and we saw that it's primarily nitrogen and oxygen. Hydrogen and helium are the most abundant elements in the universe. In other stars, we know that hydrogen and helium combined are 99% of all the atoms in the universe. So why is it virtually absent from the Earth? Well, the answer for that turns out to be is that because these atoms are small and light, hydrogen's one proton, helium is two protons and two neutrons, the two lightest elements, because they're light, they move very fast. They move so fast, in fact, that their mean atomic speeds at a typical temperature and pressure on the Earth are actually greater than the speed to escape from the Earth's gravity. And so they simply evaporate off the planet as soon as you release them. You release hydrogen or helium. After all, what do we use for lighter-than-air craft? hydrogen, until we had the old Hindenburg go boom, and that sort of made things bad. Helium blimps, they're lighter than air. Why are they lighter than air? Well, because they're a light gas. Even at high pressure, they're relatively lighter than the same volume of air around them. If you release them in the atmosphere, they literally float off of the Earth's atmosphere in some time. So even if the Earth was born out of a very rich hydrogen-helium cloud, and there's some details here we'll talk about later, any hydrogen or helium that might have come onto the Earth as part of formation long since escaped from the Earth's gravity. Only the heavier molecules, nitrogen, oxygen, water, carbon dioxide, methane, all that stuff, are heavy enough and move slow enough to be trapped by the Earth's gravity and retained by the atmosphere. This idea of atmosphere retention and what kind of atmosphere you build, depending upon the type of planet you are, the size of your planet, is extremely important, so I want to go into it in a little detail. This is probably the most mathematical thing I'm going to show, but I have no other way to do this. I need two numbers to understand this. The ability of a planet to retain an atmosphere depends upon its mass and its temperature. Okay, let's look at two of these pieces, the mass part. The more massive a planet is, has a bigger escape speed, the faster you've got to be going to break away from its gravity. The escape speed scales like the square root of the mass divided by the radius. G is the gravity constant because we're talking about the gravity of the Earth or gravity of anything. And this factor of 2 just comes out of the mathematics of doing escape speed. So, if I go to a planet which is 100 times more massive than the Earth for the same size, the escape speed from that is the square root of 100 or 10 times faster, which means I've got to be moving 10 times faster to break free of its gravity. Similarly, if I go to a planet that's 1% the mass of the Earth, then I will get the square root of 1% or 10% the escape speed, and so it's easy to escape from a given distance from a smaller mass. So the bigger the mass, the faster you've got to be going to escape gravity. That's the first part that this equation shows. The second piece is that, remember we talked about what temperature of gases are. It's the speed of all those individual molecules. I make a gas hotter, the molecules go faster inside the box. Now I'm going to show you the number. What we call the thermal speed, V thermal, is equal to the square root of the temperature of the gas divided by the mass of the molecule involved. So there's two pieces here. How hot the gas is in temperature and whether I've got a small or a big molecule. The K is a thermal constant. It's called the Boltzmann constant. It basically comes out from thermodynamics. And the 3 there has to do with the fact that I'm moving in 3 dimensions. Okay, so what does this mean? It means that at a given temperature, a bigger molecule is going to move smaller because the molecule appears in the bottom of the fraction here. If I have 100 times bigger molecule at the same temperature, it's going to move the square root of 100 or 10 times slower. So, two pieces are involved here. If the planet's mass goes up, the escape speed goes up. That means it can hold on to higher temperature, lighter gases. So, a massive planet can hold on to essentially all gases, even when that planet is hot. I think I added these words this morning. You can scribble them on your notes. Smaller planets, however, need to be colder to hold on to their gases. They need to reduce the speed of the individual gas atoms. Well, they can't change the mass because mass is mass if you're hydrogen or helium. So the only way you're going to hold on to a light gas is if you make the temperature really cold. So it's two factors. Your gravity and how hot you are will determine whether you can hold on to a gas or whether that gas is moving fast enough to escape from gravity. And we call that combined effect atmospheric retention. Okay. I'm going to illustrate this with a plot. This plot's very important. We're going to see this over and over again through this class. So this is its premiere. Let me explain this. This, on the x-axis, on the horizontal axis, I've plotted the temperature, and I've used a logarithmic scale, which jumps in factors of 10. So I have a temperature of 1,000 degrees Kelvin, temperature of 100 degrees Kelvin. To set your scale, 300 degrees Kelvin is room temperature. This is a slightly warmer room than most, but in fact, room temperature is about 300 Kelvin, about right there. Now, the temperature I plotted here, the y-axis, the vertical axis, is the escape speed of in kilometers per second, and then each of the lines here is for different elements, different molecules or atoms. So for example, hydrogen is a very light atom, so at a temperature of 1,000 degrees, it's going to have a very high escape speed. Molecular hydrogen, two hydrogens together, is twice as massive. It's going to have the square root of 2 less velocity, so it moves a little slower. Helium is 4 particles, or 4 times hydrogen, so at the same temperature, it moves slower still. And then I get methane, water vapor in blue. Nitrogen and carbon dioxide actually have the same mass, carbon monoxide. Carbon dioxide's heavier still. So as I go to heavier elements on a line of constant temperature, which is a vertical line in this diagram, the heavier the element, the slower it moves. Now the dots. What I've plotted is, for each planet in the solar system, the moon, a couple of moons of Jupiter, we won't worry about all the details here, but let's look at the Earth. This is the temperature at the top of the atmosphere, at the thermosphere, because that's the place where the escape occurs. The escape doesn't occur down the surface. The escape occurs at the transition between atmosphere and space, between the thermosphere and the exosphere. So that's why, even though surface temperature of the Earth is 300 Kelvin, the exosphere is closer to 1,000 degrees Kelvin in that high thermosphere-exosphere transition. Venus also has a hot thermosphere. What do we see? Well, what we see is this is the escape speed from that layer for its temperature. At that temperature, helium, molecular hydrogen, and atomic hydrogen are all moving faster than the Earth's escape speed, so they can escape easily. Whereas methane, water vapor, nitrogen and carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide are all moving slower than the escape speed, and so they can be retained. They can be held on by gravity. Let's now go to a place like the moon. Right now, the moon has no atmosphere. We say the moon is airless. But in fact, the moon could have had an atmosphere in the past. It's pretty cold, about 300 Kelvin, actually less than 300 Kelvin. It's actually about 270 Kelvin, about the temperature of water freezing. Well, but it's very small. It's got 1/6 the surface gravity of the Earth. That gives it an escape speed which is slower than nitrogen, carbon monoxide, water vapor, methane, helium, molecular hydrogen, atomic hydrogen. CO2 is also just above the line. So I could build a CO2 atmosphere on the moon, but it can't hold on to it. Its gravity is too weak, and over time it will simply evaporate away. Now if I go to the outer solar system, to a place like Titan, Titan is a big moon. It's actually bigger than our moon, but it's very cold at Titan because it's a moon of the planet Saturn. So even though it's got a higher escape speed because of its bigger mass, it's a colder place. So notice that now the escape speed for methane, water vapor, nitrogen, and carbon dioxide are less than Titan. So even though Titan is only a little bit bigger than the moon, because it's colder out there, Titan can hold on to an atmosphere. And in fact, Saturn's giant moon Titan has one of the heaviest atmospheres, has the heaviest atmosphere of any moon in the solar system. It's actually got 1.5 times the Earth's surface pressure. But it's mostly a methane, nitrogen atmosphere, as it happens. In fact, the primary constituents of Titan's atmosphere are nitrogen and methane, both of which are below the level. Mars sits out in between, in kind of this band where Earth and Venus are. Outside this band, they can't hold on to hydrogen helium. Now, there are giant planets in the solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. They're big. They have lots of gravity. They can hold on to hydrogen and helium. They're, in fact, mostly hydrogen and helium. And, in fact, the atmospheres of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, as we're going to see later, have the same composition as the Sun, as the same, to a first approximation, the same composition, mostly hydrogen and helium, as the raw material the Sun formed out of. Why? Because they're out in the outer solar system where it's cold, and they're very massive. So it's both your mass and your temperature that determines planetary atmosphere retention. We're going to come back to this picture. We're going to put doodads on this picture all through this class. This is a huge, gives us a huge amount of insight into the nature of what kind of atmosphere a planet's going to have, and therefore what kind of conditions are going to be on that planet if we want to consider its habitability potential. So it's a very important diagram. We're going to see it a lot. But let's turn back to the Earth. So why is the Earth so warm? If the Earth had no atmosphere, if there was no atmosphere, no air around the Earth at all, the Earth's temperature would be determined by a balance between the amount of sunlight that's absorbed by the Earth, that's kind of a gain factor, and by the infrared photons emitted by the hot Earth. Hot objects radiate infrared radiation, called blackbody radiation. That forms a form of loss. If you leave something warm outside, it eventually will radiate its heat away and become cold. So if the Earth is heated up and I turn the sun off, the Earth would very quickly cool off to the temperature of deep space, a couple degrees above absolute zero. But in fact, the Earth is warm. So if I take the amount of sunlight hitting the Earth, and I can measure that, I take the amount of radiation emitted by an object like the Earth at the distance of the Earth from the sun, and I balance energy coming in from energy being radiated, those will eventually come into balance. And that balance can be represented by what we call an equilibrium temperature. Higher temperatures radiate more, low temperatures radiate less. So if I hit you with a lot of sunlight, you have to radiate a lot of infrared radiation to balance gain against loss, heating versus cooling, and therefore you will have a higher temperature. If you have a small amount of sunlight, you're getting less sunlight in, therefore you have to radiate less to balance heating versus cooling, and that's a lower temperature. So if I do that calculation for an airless Earth, I get 260 degrees Kelvin. But water freezes at 273 degrees Kelvin. So an airless Earth would be 13 degrees Kelvin, 13 degrees Celsius, colder than the temperature of ice. So water on an airless Earth would be literally frozen. Now, there's some details I'm glossing over, but basically what this means is without the atmosphere, if we just simply balanced heating by sunlight by the re-radiation of the Earth would be too cold for liquid water. It would be a snowball Earth, as I've shown in this little computer drawing here. But except for the fact that it occasionally snows, we are not an ice planet. We are a wet, warm water planet. Why is that? Why is the Earth not frozen solid? The answer turns out to be something called the greenhouse effect. Where does all that sunlight go? Well, it doesn't just hit the Earth. This is a really detailed diagram. I don't expect you to get the numbers, but get the big picture here. I've got sunlight coming in. That's my source of heating. And then two things can happen to that. It can be absorbed or it can be reflected. So where does it go? Well, 51% of the radiation actually makes it to the ground and gets absorbed. So 51% of sunlight on a clear, cloudless day is absorbed by ground. 4% on average is reflected off the ground. Now, that's an average. If I land on green or dark ground, I absorb more, or reflect less is maybe a better way of putting it. If I've got snow, snow is really shiny, I reflect a lot. So this represents an average for the surface of 51% absorption and 4% reflection. That includes oceans. If there are clouds around, the clouds obviously are blocking sunlight from getting to the Earth. If we take the average cloud cover of the Earth, about 20% of sunlight hitting the Earth is reflected off of clouds back into space, but about 3% is actually absorbed by the clouds. Sunlight heats the clouds a little bit, and so that radiation gets absorbed and turns into heat. Similarly, the atmosphere actually has some particulates in it. It has atoms and molecules. 16% of the sunlight going through the atmosphere is absorbed, but some of the atmosphere is actually slightly reflected at about the 6% level. So when I do all the math, when I do the full budget, I got to get 100% in, balances 100% out. What I find is that 51% of the sunlight is absorbed by the grounds and the oceans, 19% is absorbed by the atmosphere, and the remaining 30% is reflected back into space. So the calculation I did for the Earth with no atmosphere is 100% absorption. Actually, I modified a little bit, but not by much. So now we've got 51% absorption plus 19% by the atmosphere and only 30% reflected back. Why do we still have any warmth? And the answer is because of the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect is an effect which basically leads to trapping of heat in the Earth's atmosphere, trapping of infrared radiation, which is heat radiation, which would basically heats the atmosphere by trapping it. So the temperature of the Earth is actually warmer by about 35 degrees Celsius than it would be if it had no atmosphere from that simple computation. How this works is as follows. Sunlight is mostly visible light. It passes through the Earth's atmosphere and is absorbed by the ground. The sunlight warms up the ground. The warm ground re-radiates its energy as infrared photons. Not visible light, but infrared light. Now here's the deal. The atmosphere may be transparent to visible light, but it is largely opaque, not transparent, to infrared light. This is an actual plot of the opacity of the Earth's atmosphere in the infrared part of the spectrum, the far red beyond where we can see. A 1 on this diagram would be 100% transparent. 0 is 100% black. And notice that the Earth's atmosphere is not transparent, but is broken up by these extremely deep band structures, big gaps, some places like out here between 14 and 16 microns, where the atmosphere literally goes black. If we had infrared eyes, and I could switch from visible light to 14 micron infrared with our eyes, what I would see is I would suddenly see the room suddenly fill with fog. Literally fog. What is the absorption? Well, what some of this is due to water molecules. There's water vapors, a major constituent of our atmosphere. So the strong absorption around 1 micron, between 6 and 8 microns, and from 18 microns and up of wavelength, these are all absorption bands and water molecules. The deep band at around 14 to 16 is carbon dioxide. There are two other very stronger bands between 3 microns and 4 microns. There's other bands. There's ozone. We often think of ozone as a UV absorber, but in fact, ozone is also an infrared absorber. So the combination of all of these is take the infrared photons that want to shine out back into space, but they're blocked and absorbed by these strong molecular absorption bands in the atmosphere. They act like a blanket. They trap the heat that would normally escape into space, and because they trap the heat, the Earth's atmosphere raises up. Just like on a cold night. Right? If all you were putting on top of you was a thin linen bedsheet, you get pretty cold really fast. How do you get yourself warmer? You start throwing on the layers. You put on a big down comforter, and pretty soon it's too hot, and you got one leg sticking out just to cool off. Only the cat loves the down comforter as much as I do on a cold night. The Earth's atmosphere, this opacity from molecules, acts like a blanket. It traps the heat that would normally escape into space and warms the atmosphere by 35 degrees Celsius. The greenhouse effect makes the difference between snowball Earth and liquid water Earth. And we're going to see the play of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere is going to be very, very important to us. Well, I'm behind. All right. So where did, in fact, the Earth's atmosphere grow? What is the history of the Earth's atmosphere? This will be a quick run through this because we're in the last few minutes of class, but we're going to look at this in more detail on Thursday. Most of the early gases, the Earth started out very hot. A hot planet cannot hold on to gases. So the original first atmosphere of the Earth was lost to space. It was too hot to hold on to anything. Even carbon dioxide and water vapor got blown off. But eventually, volcanoes belch out a lot of dissolved gases. Water vapor and carbon dioxide, plus some other stuff like hydrogen sulfide, sulfur dioxide, and carbon monoxide, but no oxygen, no O2. So the first atmosphere is going to be heavy with carbon dioxide and water vapor. As the Earth was hitting fairly cool, that water vapor condenses into water and rain and builds the first oceans. When we look at the history of the Earth, we're going to see that ocean building happened very rapidly. There is a little bit of oxygen here. It comes mostly from photochemistry of UV radiation hitting molecules. But there's an awful lot of minerals capable of being oxidized, like iron. So we see these ancient red-banded rocks, which whatever little oxygen we make immediately makes all the iron, free iron, rust until we run out of iron. So if any oxygen is produced in the early primordial atmosphere, it's lost completely to mineral oxidation. So the Earth's atmosphere is born with carbon dioxide and water vapor, but no oxygen, and little tiny amounts of nitrogen. Now, it turns out the primordial atmosphere is 1,000 times denser, 1,000 times more carbon dioxide than in the atmosphere today. If the Earth's atmosphere was the same as the original atmosphere, we couldn't breathe it. We would be poisoned immediately, and the Earth would be under such a heavy greenhouse blanket, its temperature would go right through the roof. But why didn't that happen to Earth? And the answer is because of water. Because we're at a temperature range where water can be liquid, water can dissolve carbon dioxide. So as water vapor rains out of the atmosphere, it dissolves up some of the carbon dioxide in that water and gets trapped in ocean water. Ocean water has a lot of dissolved carbon dioxide in it. But it can only hold so much. If you put too much of a compound in water, dissolved in water, what's going to happen? It's going to supersaturate and it's going to start to precipitate. And it precipitates out as carbonates, carbon-bearing minerals, that sink to the bottom of the oceans. So the water, carbon dioxide, dissolves into the oceans. The oceans are rich in carbon dioxide. Precipitation leads to the formation of carbonate rocks, primarily limestones, calcium carbonate. It's a reaction with calcium and other elements in the water, dissolved in the water. Nitrogen, too, is virtually chemically inert. So it stays behind in the atmosphere. So what happens is, because there's been liquid water on our planet, the carbon dioxide is slowly rained out of the original atmosphere, leaving nitrogen behind, but locking up the carbon dioxide. It doesn't escape into space. It gets locked into crustal rock as carbonate rocks and dissolved in the oceans. The atmosphere becomes, from carbon dioxide and water vapor, to a place with liquid water oceans, carbon locked in carbonate rocks, and nitrogen left behind with traces of the rest. So here's an example of just how much carbon dioxide. Here is the Earth's original atmosphere. It's locked up in carbonates, in things like this limestone formation that's now been pushed above the Earth's surface by geologic activity. This one is out in County Roscommon, Ireland. But the White Cliffs of Dover and places like that, more places where you've locked up the ancient carbon dioxide. This is the remnants of the Earth's original atmosphere. Now, where does the oxygen come from? There's no oxygen in this atmosphere, but we've 21% oxygen now. The answer turns out to be, as we're going to see later in the class, about 2.4 billion years ago, the first photosynthetic organisms began to produce a lot of oxygen. The photosynthesis converts carbon dioxide and water into sugars and oxygen. The oxygen content, in fact, increased dramatically from 1% up to 21% only during the last 600 million years of the Earth's history. So oxygen is a relatively recent thing in the Earth's history, geologically speaking. The last less than a quarter, less than a fifth of the Earth's history have we had an oxygen-rich atmosphere. The other place we see oxygen is ozone. It forms up in the stratosphere when some of that O2, the molecular oxygen, gets hit by sunlight UV radiation. This is good because it blocks the UV from reaching the ground and makes life on land possible. Otherwise, any organism would rapidly begin to mutate under heavy UV radiation bombardment. So it's a big deal. If you've got ozone or O2 in abundance in an atmosphere, you've probably got life. This is a biomarker. This is something we see in the Earth. We can look at the history of oxygen in the Earth, and it gives us something to look for in other planets. So oxygen and ozone are signs of life, not just on our Earth, but maybe the biomarkers we use on other planets. Here's an example of one of these fossil stromatolite beds. Stromatolites are these blue-green algae mats that produce the first oxygen on Earth, these so-called cyanobacteria. We're going to meet these later. I'll just flash this picture up at you. So the bottom line from today is that the Earth's atmosphere is very complex, it's dynamic, it's a system. It's not just sitting there. And it's evolved over the history of the Earth. The past evolution is that we get mostly water condensing into the oceans, locking up the carbon dioxide that was in the air, in the ocean water and carbon dioxide, in the rock, in carbonaceous rocks, and then we get the formation of oxygen later by the action of life. No life, no oxygen. The evolution is continuing to the present day. As we're going to see, there is a complex carbon dioxide cycle in our atmosphere that's been important through its history. We're going to see increases in carbon dioxide and methane due to the action of life. And we're going to also see that human activity is also beginning to affect the contents of our atmosphere. We'll talk about this more on Thursday. We talk about the climate history of the Earth. But this sets the stage for the two pieces we need to understand the history of the Earth and therefore the history of life on Earth. Any questions? Okay, in that case, I'll see you all tomorrow.